Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
An Erio's original.
Representation is so important.
It's so important.
I've told people this, like, before I saw Margaret on television, I didn't think it was possible for me to do stand-up because no one looked like me, so How could I ever do this for a living? It's taking over my dreams, waking me out of my sleep.
I think I'm coming apart. Hi, I'm Margaret Cho. Welcome to The Margaret Cho, my podcast. Here's my conversation with Robin Tran, who is a comedian that I am obsessed with. She's hilarious. She's my muse. And she's also somebody that I really get to get into Mortal Minorities, which is my little fun thing on this show where we talk about Asian Americans and crime. Yeah, coming out of the dark. I have, like, a chafing issue.
Yeah.
I feel like I just need a Band-Aid or something between my legs. Do you have chafing?
What?
Do you chafe?
Yeah.
With, like, a skirt?
Yeah. Yeah, with a skirt or, like, a short dress.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Do you think, like, when you're transitioning, like, did you kind of put that into, like, some thought into, like, how this is good, like, a pants is going to feel next to, like, a dress? But you still wear pants a lot.
Well, I do now. When I first came out, I didn't think about any of that stuff. I just thought, like, oh, this is going to be weird that I'm going to start wearing dresses and skirts and stuff at open mics.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought about how, like, a lot of my comic friends, like, comedian friends, unfollowed me on Facebook because I'm insufferable on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, oh, they're going to be shocked when they see me. Like, they don't know that because I came out on Facebook.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and then, so that was most of what was going through my mind.
Mm-hmm. Why do you say insufferable?
Oh, I used to just post like 50 statuses a day about politics and stuff. This is before I was medicated.
Well, I mean, I think all of that is really important to do, too. I mean, I don't have Facebook, so I don't really know.
Yeah.
But I think that's a place where you do it.
Right.
You know, where you have to talk about what's happening in the world.
Yeah. I stopped doing it when I got medicated, though.
Mm.
Yeah. It was really bad for me. I was doing it so much like that people thought that they were on my page, but it was just the news feed.
Mm.
And it was like, oh my gosh, you're posting so much, I gotta unfollow you. So when I came out on Facebook, I'm like, oh man, a lot of comedians don't know that I'm out. And then they're just going to show up to an open mic one day and it's like, why is Robert in a skirt? Like, they don't even know that I'm Robin now, you
mm-hmm.
know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it's good.
Yeah.
It's good that they, you know, now you're able to, you know, talk about it, you do comedy about it.
Yeah.
Do you feel like the transition has... Well, I'm sure it's changed your comedy. I don't know if you've... Has it changed your style of comedy?
No, my style has always been very autobiographical.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started comedy, I was a virgin.
Mm.
So my first 4 or 5 months, I just talked about, I'm 25 and I'm a virgin.
Mm-hmm.
And then I met my girlfriend doing comedy and then we had sex. And then I lost my virginity and then we went to an open mic later that night.
Mm-hmm.
I just took my notebook and I threw it across the room and I'm like, well, guys, I got no more material, you know? And then I did material about being Asian and being persecuted, whatever, you know, for mm-hmm. a while. And then I talked about just like my struggles of being a guy that's not, doesn't fit in.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came out as transgender, a transgender woman, and I had to throw out all that material too.
Yeah.
Like every time I did something different, I had to throw away a certain amount of material.
Mm-hmm.
So my style has always been just keeping up with whatever is going on with my life. Like, almost like my audience can follow along with me.
Yeah. And your search to realize all of these different things about yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's really also, like, when you are in comedy young, as we both are, where, yeah. And then, because I was pretty young when I started, so it's like you discover who you are on the stage in a lot of ways.
Absolutely.
You know, you discover your life by talking about it.
Yeah.
Which I think is really, it's really important.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I am. I don't know. I don't know if I should say this, but I'm getting kind of almost resentful that I came up with such good transgender material.
Uh-huh.
Because it's a lot of jokes about how I look and everything in the dress, and I look like a giant baby that found a dress, you know, like things like that, you know, like it's very funny, like just things I've done for years now. And it's like now I'm getting kind of lazy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like dressing up as much as I used to. You know, mm-hmm. I think that's like I went through the phases of being a girl, like in this, like I sped up.
Yeah.
You know, like I went through the junior high phase and the high school phase and the college phase and everything. And now I'm in the I don't want to dress up anymore phase.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And now I can't really do that if I show up to a mic mm-hmm. or a show because I have all my material is about how I look in a dress.
Yeah.
So yeah. I have to find a new phase in my stand up, I think.
Well, I think it's really like it's like I definitely have that like femme fatigue.
Yeah.
When you.
Is that what it is?
Yeah. It's like you just get tired of all of the aspects of femininity that require a lot of work, which yeah. is getting dressed, makeup yeah. to a certain extent, but also the fiddly aspects of it. You know, some things like sometimes, you know, women's clothes are uncomfortable.
It is very uncomfortable sometimes.
Yeah.
I have one purple dress that's comfortable still and I wear it everywhere
mm-hmm.
and everything else doesn't fit me anymore. Or just like it doesn't fit, doesn't, you know, it doesn't feel good on my skin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I went from I can't wait to wear makeup to makeup is oppressive in like, yeah. like 4 years.
And annoying. It's like in your eyes and in your mouth. And right. like I find it to be it's hard to eat.
It is.
With like a lipstick.
Yeah. So like I've like found out a way to like eat just using my teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And I even do that now when I'm not wearing lipstick, just like as a habit. And I don't like
it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's also like, well, these are the trappings of femininity that define our gender, I guess.
Right.
But they don't really. I mean, these are just a certain kind of femininity.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a style and that, you know, you're figuring out what it is you want to use, what it is you want to keep, you know, and what you don't have to do.
Yeah. I'm still trying to figure it all out.
It's good.
Yeah. I think I'm a very lazy girl, I think.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
It's okay. I mean, that's definitely a style. And also, like, comedians in general, like, we don't want to put so much work into our appearance because then it seems forced. Like, our presence as entertainers is meant to be certainly somewhat casual, I think.
Yeah.
I think a very manicured, groomed, dressed up comedian is suspect.
Yeah, I agree with that.
You know, because you're kind of like, oh, you know, I mean, I guess that you can sort of argue like, well, it can be specifically branded like somebody like Joan Rivers,
mm-hmm.
who put a tremendous amount of work and money into her appearance.
Yeah.
But and had the material to back it up.
Right.
You know, so there are definitely exceptions. But in general, like you sort of want comedians to be kind of like, I don't know, a little more accessible physically.
I kind of like it. A little dirty, you mm-hmm. know, a little bit sloppy. Mm-hmm. I like my comedy like that.
Yeah, me too. Because you want them to be like, I don't know, there's a familiarity
yeah,
in a
like,
comedian.
Like I feel like I'm at home watching mm-hmm. it.
Yeah. I never want to work that hard. Also, like if you're on the road a lot, it's really hard to actually like get it all together where you look great. You know, like I don't want to yeah. have to do all of that stuff.
Yeah. Also, I don't know. I'm afraid to do the road. I've never done the road because I don't think it's safe everywhere for trans people.
It's hard. It can yeah. be. But I think like, well, where the capacity in that, you know, you're doing right now, like you just did Clusterfest, which is very, very big.
Yeah.
You know, and that's San Francisco, which is, you know, I think it's great to be trans and Asian American.
It is.
In San Francisco.
Yeah.
You know, and I think now the world is shifting. You know, we're going into a space of people have awareness about, like, violence against trans people.
Yeah.
So, you know, you should be safe.
Yeah. I mean, San Francisco was, like, they were so welcoming.
Mm-hmm.
It was, like, one of the greatest, it might be the greatest crowd I've ever performed in front of.
That's
you know?
Awesome.
Yeah, you come, you walk out on stage and they already assume that you're brave and stunning and everything.
Yeah,
You're a hero, even though we don't even know you're a good person, but
yeah.
we're going to assume that you are. It's almost like, almost condescending. That's how nice they are.
Well, I think when you're coming on stage, also as an Asian American,
yeah.
there's immediate support because we haven't had that sort of presence sort of in comedy as acknowledged.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have that history in comedy as, you know, like these cis white guys have had, straight cis white guys have had for centuries, you know?
Yeah.
So when you're Asian American in San Francisco doing something very public and very big that is kind of mocking the establishment, you have a great vote of confidence from the people.
Yeah, I find that, you know, when I was in San Francisco, like just being an Asian American comedian, even before I transitioned, when I'd go on stage, like I almost got like an advantage because the standards that people set were so low. They're like, oh, there's no way this person's going to be funny because they're Asian, you know? So like you do any joke that even resembles a joke and they're like, oh, it's like this laugh of surprise. Like,
yeah.
Someone's like, oh my God, this person can talk and put together a thought, you know? It's very insulting for mm-hmm. And I just had that chip on my shoulder for a while, I think. Like, yeah, Asian people could be funny.
Mm-hmm. And we need to be.
Yeah.
We need to be. And I think it's really, and it's like important because comedy is really about, you're kind of criticizing the establishment. You're criticizing the status quo.
Right.
And calling attention to certain things about it that are uncomfortable and bad. And so we need comedians. We need Asian American comedians desperately because we don't have that real mainstream acceptance or establishment as such. So we're sort of like minorities out there.
Right. Yeah.
So it's good to have our voice in there.
Yeah. Representation is so important.
It's so important. And yeah. It's like, you know, I'm excited about nowadays we're seeing a lot more Asian American comedians and it's quite a commodity now.
Yeah. Well, it was for a while, it was just you, right? Mm-hmm. You were the only one for like years or decades.
Yeah. Decades. So yeah. It's really exciting to see more people.
I've told people this, like, before I saw Margaret on television, I didn't think it was possible for me to do stand-up because no one looked like me. So mm-hmm. how could I ever do this for a living? And
I
wasn't just me. Other people in my class were like, oh, yeah, what about Margaret Cho? If she could mm-hmm. do it, I could do it, you know? And that's why it's so important.
Yeah, because if you can see somebody do it, then you can visualize it for yourself.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's so important. I guess I didn't have examples. The only person that I can think of was like Johnny Yoon, who was a Korean comedian. He made a movie in the 70s called They Call Me Bruce.
Oh.
Might have been early 80s. And he was from South Korea. And I think he was kind of friends with Johnny Carson or something because he was actually on The Tonight Show a bunch.
Oh, wow.
I met him. He's a nice guy. He's like definitely very like a Korean older gentleman.
Oh.
So you don't sort of see that 70s like stand-up comic exactly now. But it's really like, it's amazing that he existed. And so because he was there, I kind of thought, well, maybe I could try this. I don't know.
Right. Yeah. You know?
And when I first started comedy, I was immediately kind of supported by this industry that wanted different voices.
Right.
You know, and San Francisco is that kind of place where they really welcome diversity. They always have.
Oh, wow.
So that's where comedy was really, it was a good thing to start with. Where did you start doing sets?
Orange County.
Mm-hmm.
There was an Orange County comedy scene.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a place called Max Bloom's. It doesn't exist anymore. It's in Fullerton. And it was just this little coffee shop. I remember wondering if I could curse, you know, so I just kept calling, like, can I curse? And I talk mm-hmm. about this and that. Can I curse on this podcast?
Yes, or? Yes, yes.
Yeah, so I was just talking about, like, oh, I'm just going to talk about masturbation a bunch. That's what most male comedians do when they start, right? And from the pictures, it looked like a club. I didn't know how comedy worked.
Mm-hmm.
So I got there and it was a coffee shop. And I'm thinking, like, no one wants to hear about masturbation in a coffee shop, right? Like, and then when the open mic started, I was nervous, you know. And then every comic talked about masturbation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, this is gross, but I guess, like, I can do it also.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I had my first set, I guess my masturbation jokes were really good. And then I was just going to do it once and then quit.
Yeah.
And I ended up being really good at it, like my first set. And then they're like, okay, just keep going. And then there was a guy named Evan. I'm still friends with him. And then he showed me all the other open mics around Orange County.
Mm-hmm.
Like there was a place called Paradise Perks and like Starlight Theater and just like these little places in Orange County.
Mm-hmm.
We created our own scene. And it wasn't until, like, I did Roast Battle that I started doing L.A. more in 2015. Yeah.
Yeah. And Roast Battle is a very big deal. I mean, Roast Battle is a huge kind of franchise.
It is,
It's out there in every comedy festival and in television. And, you know, you really see a lot of it. And it's a tough thing.
It is.
Like, I would be scared. So what is your experience like doing that?
Well, first of all, they call me Margaret Chode.
Which is the best.
At the Comedy Store. No, I did. I've always loved roasting since I saw it when I was a kid. I saw Jeff Ross doing a set mm-hmm. at the Drew Carey roast. Oh, you did the Drew Carey roast too. Yeah, you mm-hmm. did haikus and stuff. I remember watching that thing, and that's the funniest thing I've ever seen. Yeah. I didn't know that you can express love through comedy mm-hmm. like that. And that was one of the first things I saw that I'm like, I actually want to do that for a living. Mm-hmm. And when I heard there was something called roast battle, I was like, okay, I'm all in, even though I'm kind of agoraphobic. I'll do that once and then I'll quit too. That's my whole life.
You like to do it one time.
I like to do one thing and then quit, you know, because I like to quit everything. Uh-huh. And then I told my first joke at the roast battle against my friend Tim. And God, what was the joke? It was something like 12 steps is a program he'll never join and a distance he'll never run or something. Something like that. And then the crowd just went, wow. Like they started screaming and yelling and running around, you know, like. And I'm like, wow, that's a really addicting feeling. And then that mm-hmm. was when I was like, I need to just keep doing this to get that reaction again. Yeah. It's like a drug.
Yeah.
And then they showed me so much love in mm-hmm. a way, even though they were making fun of me. Mm-hmm. Like someone came up and gave me flowers afterwards, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was thinking like, you know, this is the perfect amount of making fun of me and showing me love. Because everything else, but when I first transitioned, it was either people were really mean to me or people were way too nice to me. Mm. People were afraid to make fun of me. And that was like a place where I'm like, look, you can still make fun of me as long as it's like respectful.
Yeah.
And that was why I did it. You know, I've been doing it for years now.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Yeah.
Because there's an element too of like Fight Club.
Yeah, there is. Like 8 Mile, Fight Club. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of that stuff.
Like survival of the fittest.
Yeah.
There.
Would you ever do it?
I don't know, you know, because it's to me, it's like, it seems like, though, it's for the young people.
They can
think much faster and on their feet than I can, you know, and it's intimidating to me. So I kind of think like I do appreciate it. I've done like the judging on it, which is really fun too.
Yeah.
But I think I find it quite intimidating. So I really respect everybody that actually does it.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's really cool.
Yeah.
It's exciting to watch.
It is.
It's fun. And that the roasts in general from the Friars Club, they were a little bit different in that it was mostly like comics just getting together. You know, in the late 80s and early 90s, when I would go to the Friars Club, when they would have these sort of roasts for each other, they weren't televised.
Right.
They were like, just so that the comics could hang out. Yeah. And they would like all like get excited about one comic coming down and doing a set. And so it's great to see that camaraderie. But in the Drew Carey roast, I was sitting next to Dom Irrera, and we were sitting in between all these other people, but Joey Adams was there, who's this like really long time like columnist, old friar. He was in his 90s. And Joey walked back behind the dais that we were sitting on, and he fell through the floor.
Oh my God.
And he was like laying there. He like fell like really hard, and he was just out cold. And he later died from his injuries.
Oh my God.
So we were going to be subpoenaed to do the civil suit against the Friars Club that I think, I don't know, I think his wife at the time, who was also a gossip columnist, she was suing the Friars Club. But they ended up not, I think they settled out of court. But that was the weird death at the roast that happened.
That's crazy.
Of Joey Adams, which is really crazy. That's my memory of the one roast that I was at that somebody died.
So what made me want to do comedy is also the venue where someone died.
Yes. So, you know, it's lots of different experiences at the same place.
It all comes full circle, yeah.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
In this theme of death, which is what I wanted to talk to you about. So now we're going to do, you're the first person that we're doing this. This is a segment of this podcast that I'm calling Mortal Minorities.
Okay.
And it's when Asian Americans kill.
Okay.
So this is like an interesting case that I wanted to discuss with you. It's a woman named Jennifer Pan, and she's a Vietnamese Canadian woman of Chinese Vietnamese ancestry, convicted of a 2010 kill-for-hire attack targeting both her parents.
Oh, my God.
So, and this was in response to what she deemed their seriously abusive tiger parenting. And I'm taking all, this all out of Wikipedia. And at the front of this, it just says the neutrality of this article is disputed. So we'll see what if where it's where okay. it's fair and where yeah. it's not. Did you grow up in a very oppressive household?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
I wasn't allowed to like leave the house.
Mm-hmm.
That was like grounded forever.
Like you couldn't go out like after school or?
No, like if I like had drama after school, like drama class, like, and I left at four, I got home at 4 instead of 2:30, my mom would like call the police.
Mm.
Like it was really, really bad.
Because they were, what were they afraid of? I mean, were they afraid that?
That I would be murdered.
Oh, okay.
My mom would have dreams of me being murdered oh. and tell me about it. Like, so whenever I watch, like, television and it was, like, a white kid got grounded for a week, I'm like, you can get grounded for only a week? I've been grounded for, like, 10 years now.
Yeah, like your whole life.
Yeah, I didn't know what that meant. Yeah.
Like, I think but it was motivated by their own fear of yeah. the world.
Right.
You know, so was your mother at home with you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I still kind of have a little bit of the agoraphobia. Like when I leaving the house is really hard for me.
Well, because if they're raising you to believe that you're living in an unsafe world.
That's right.
That's definitely scary.
My first therapy session, he said, "Their death is not around every corner." And I started crying. Mm-hmm. And this is like 2 months ago. I'm 33 now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still like that. Yeah, it really messed me up.
Yeah, because it's like, of course, it's like you only find out about the world from your parents.
Yeah.
So how would you even know that? To question them, like, you know,
yeah.
it's like all these beliefs that we have really come from them.
Yeah.
You know, because with my family, the thing is like when I was growing up, they were just not there because they were working.
Oh, okay.
So in the 70s, they didn't have a sense of like, oh, we need to be home with our kids. Like we need a babysitter.
Oh, wow.
Like they were like, oh, they're fine. They'll be fine.
That's messed up in its own way, I think.
Yeah. it was isolating. It was like, yeah. I just grew up in an empty house.
Oh my gosh.
Which is... You know, it is scary in its own way, but now I really prefer to be alone
yeah.
all the time. It's kind of like I have some, whatever, it's like that kind of thing of like being with other people is really taxing.
Yeah.
You know, and so it has left its mark
yeah.
of like now it's made me kind of a permanent loner.
Yeah, no, I get that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I kind of have a little bit of that too. I'm
yeah.
codependent on like one person, which is my girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, people are very taxing for me because I don't have a lot of experience outside talking to people.
Right.
Yeah.
So of course it's going to require a lot of energy
yeah.
to deal with the outside world. When you're sort of feeling like I'm going to be combative,
yeah.
I might have to fight.
Right.
So, I mean, with Jennifer Pan, it's a kind of thing of like where I understand like her parents really valued education. So she wasn't really able to do anything except school. And they really made sure that, you know, she had really great grades. And that was a big part of her upbringing is that they were very strict with her and they wanted her to be amazing in school. Like most Asian American parents
right.
or Asian parents are that way.
Yeah.
You know, like they just have a huge emphasis on education and your ability to perform in school is really related to how much they're going to love you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I had that too.
Yeah. So they were this, I think, upwardly mobile to a certain extent. They were in Toronto. They were living in a suburb of Toronto where they had a two-car garage,
mm-hmm.
which is a big deal for Asian people to have a two-car garage. And they had a Lexus and a Mercedes-Benz.
Oh, wow.
And $200,000 in Canadian money and savings.
Oh, my gosh.
And Jennifer's parents set a lot of goals for her. She was taking piano lessons very young, as well as figure skating lessons very young. So, the emphasis of achievement
right.
was always kind of put down to let her. Her father, Han... was considered a classic tiger dad, tiger
mm-hmm.
mom, tiger dad, that Han was the dad. And Bic, the mom, Bic is the reluctant accomplice.
Okay.
So I guess maybe one parent is stronger and one's weaker. So do you think your mother was stronger?
Yeah. I mean, my dad was like always gone partying and stuff. So it was mm-hmm. mostly my mom raising me. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the sort of, it's usually sort of one parent that sort of drives that sort of tiger
yeah.
strictness.
Yeah.
Now we sort of think of the tiger mom, but
yeah,
I think with my parents, it was really more of like, they were both so busy that they didn't have a chance to like assign who was going to be the tiger.
Yeah. Right.
So they, but the, in Jennifer Pan's case, it was really her dad that was was trying to push for it. You know, she attended Mary Ward Catholic Secondary School, where she played flute, and they never permitted her to date boys or to attend high school dances or proms out of fear that these activities would distract her from academic commitments.
Oh, that's awful.
Yeah. So she was just like very isolated
and having
to just do school. And she says, Jennifer Pan says, at age 22, she had never gone to a club, been drunk, visited a friend's cottage, or gone on vacation without her family. Well, by 22, you would think you would have been able to do at least a couple of those things.
Yeah.
I've never visited a friend's cottage.
Cottage, yeah. Yeah, me neither.
I don't know anybody who lives in a cottage. That's also kind of like, I mean, that's very typical of Asian Americans. It's like we're not supposed to get drunk.
Yeah, you're not supposed to date. And then it's weird with Asians Asian parents for me, like, you're not supposed to date. And then all of a sudden one day you're like, why aren't you married?
Yeah, it's like, where are you supposed to like suddenly just be married?
Yeah, exactly.
If you have no experience of the opposite sex or any sex, any relationship.
Yeah.
Like, how do you just get married?
Right. Yeah. It was like, don't date until like 23 or 24. And then all of a sudden I'm 25 and they're like, you need to date someone now.
Yeah.
Like now.
Without any experience beforehand.
Yeah.
So it's so crazy. Like what they want. Like my parents, their version of it is like, you have to eat. Why are you so fat?
my mom's like that too.
Yeah. It's like, how do you like shove food down your kid's throat and then question the fatness?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're enabling it.
It's just the blind spot.
Yeah.
So with Jennifer, despite her parents' high expectations, her grades were average in the 70% range.
Okay.
You know, which I've been around there.
Yeah, me too.
I'm like a C student in general.
I had a 0.9 GPA my first semester of UCI, and I was on academic probation.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, it was good because it was like it lowered the standards of my parents so much. Mm. They're like, okay, just get C's.
Yeah.
Like, stop getting F's and D's, you know?
Yeah, with my parents too, they were like disappointed so early that they just learned not to count on me.
Exactly.
Which is, I think, the best way to handle it.
Yeah, me too.
So with Jennifer, multiple times, she forged report cards using false templates to show her parents that she had received straight A's.
Oh my God.
When she had not. I mean, that's ballsy.
Yeah.
I would be too scared.
Yeah. I'm impressed. She's a lot smarter than her grades.
Yeah. I mean, it's like actually probably harder to do that.
Yeah.
To do a convincingly forged document.
Yeah.
Than to
actually get straight A's.
Yeah. I mean, it shows a kind of intelligence that, you know, if she had applied that to school.
Yeah.
I don't know. Jennifer failed calculus class in her senior year of high school, and Ryerson University rescinded her early admission. As she could not bear to be perceived as a failure, she began to lie to those she knew, including her parents, and pretended that she was attending university.
Wow.
It's a huge commitment to a charade. Like, I'm going to go to this school.
Right.
And all the time you have to be out.
Yeah.
To make that seem convincing. That's scary. Instead, she sat in cafes, taught as a piano instructor, and worked in a restaurant to earn money. In order to maintain the charade, Jennifer told her parents that she had won scholarships, later falsely claiming that she had accepted an offer into the pharmacology program at the University of Toronto.
Wow, this is so involved.
I mean, the big lies.
Yeah.
They get bigger and bigger as you go on because you could just, you know, you're just delaying the inevitable.
Right.
Because, you know, you're going to have to fess up.
At some point, yeah, there needs to be evidence that you're actually doing all this stuff, right?
Well, she's trying to build evidence, like she went to the extent of purchasing secondhand textbooks and watching videos related to pharmacology in order to create notebooks full of purported class notes.
Oh my God.
That she would show her parents.
Yeah.
Jennifer also requested permission from her parents to stay near the campus with a friend throughout the week.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it's like the amount of lying to sustain it gives me anxiety.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like scared.
Yeah.
She was actually staying with her boyfriend, Daniel Chiquang Wong, her high school sweetheart who her parents didn't know anything about. And, He was a student, but he also had bad grades. So, you know, they were, I guess, commiserating with this thing, that feeling.
Yeah.
So while pretending to complete her degree at University of Toronto, Pan told her parents she had started working as a volunteer at Toronto's Hospital for Sick Children, known as sick kids.
Yeah.
So Han and Bic became suspicious when they realized she did not have a hospital ID badge or uniform.
Oh, no. That's what she forgot.
She forgot. Like, I think she got cocky.
Yeah.
Like, she got cocky, like, kind of like when... It's like she settled into the lie to the point where she was like, oh, they're going to believe it.
Yeah.
I guess that would make sense because it's like if they're buying all of this, they're going to buy all of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, her parents are really perceptive.
Yeah.
That's all it took.
I guess if they start to think, I mean, of course, there's like something to say like, well, if they had an investment in believing her.
Yeah.
Because then they wouldn't have to realize that their daughter's a liar.
Yeah.
And has been lying all this time.
Yeah.
But since they were suspicious on one occasion, Bic followed her daughter to work and quickly discovered her deception.
Oh, no.
So that the jig is up. And in the state of shock, the dad wanted to throw Jennifer out, but the mother persuaded him to allow her to stay. She eventually had to try to begin working to finish high school for real.
Yeah.
Because she hadn't. And was later encouraged by her parents to apply to a university. She was forbidden to contact her boyfriend, Daniel, and couldn't go anywhere. So it was basically arrest, except for her piano teaching job.
Oh, my God.
So by 24, Jennifer was sick of it. And she, wasn't able to see Daniel. So he began to date another woman who he fell in love with. So it says Pan quickly invented a new story and told Daniel, the boyfriend, that a man had entered her house showing what appeared to be a police badge.
Okay.
She then told him that several men had rushed in and gang raped her.
Oh, my God. Oh, wow.
And after this, she insisted that a bullet was mailed to her, telling Daniel that it was sent to her from his new girlfriend.
Oh, my God.
So she's just a liar. She's just trying
that's
to,
like... That's like a pathological liar.
That's like... Now you're getting... I mean, all of it's pathological. Like, all of it's, like, so... I could kind of understand, like, the parent stuff, because I know what it is to be living in that sort of restrictive environment.
Right.
And you just want to lie so that you could just live your life.
Yeah.
But this now...
This is way, way too far, I think.
It's showing the personality that could kill somebody.
Yeah.
You know, and justify it.
Absolutely.
So in the spring of 2010, Pan was in contact with Andrew Montemayor, a high school friend who she claims had boasted in their high school years about robbing people at knife point. So Montemayor introduced her to another kid, Ricardo, a goth, who Pan gave $1,500 to kill her father in the parking lot at his workplace. Duncan says that she once gave him $200 for a night out, but that he returned it, and that he rebuffed her when she asked him to kill her parents. So it's kind of harder to find somebody.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you ask sort of the bad kids that you know around that you think of her as bad.
Yeah.
But nobody's going to be as seriously bad to kill. Yeah.
I didn't know that's how much it cost to kill somebody.
Yeah, that's kind of cheap.
Yeah, I thought it would be a lot higher than that.
You would think so.
Yeah.
So Pan and Wong, the boyfriend, were back in contact at this time, and according to the police, came up with a plan to hire a professional hitman for $10,000 to kill her parents. That's where you get the money. So calculating that if they died, that she would inherit $500,000.
Oh, wow.
Which they planned to move in together. And so Daniel, the boyfriend, connected her with Lenford Roy Crawford, who he called Homeboy. He gave her a SIM card and an iPhone so she could contact him without using her regular cell phone. So now they're sort of like, now they're using the burner phones and they're learning to sort of maybe try to cover their tracks.
Yeah, she's like an agent, like a secret agent or something.
Yeah, now she's getting into this sort of thing of like, okay, well, let's really do this.
Yeah.
So this whole thing is like kind of building up. So the murder actually took place at the Pan house. November 8th, 2010, Jennifer Pan unlocked the front door of the family home when she went to bed. Shortly after, they ended up hiring a different hitman. I can't even say the name. It's Milvaganam. Anyway, some dude. And two other people came in through the unlocked door carrying guns. I guess they didn't establish the identity of the other two hitmen because the boyfriend and the Crawford guy, they were at work. So it's different people, different players here. So these three men took the parents, Bic and Han, to the basement where they shot them multiple times.
Oh, wow.
Bic, the mom, was killed, but Han, the dad, would survive his wounds. The three men took all the cash that was in the house, including $2,000 from Jennifer, and they left. Jennifer claimed that they had tied her up, but that she managed to free her hands and dial 911. Han, the dad, was treated at the hospital and he was moved to the trauma unit by aircraft, some serious injuries. The evening after the murder, Pan Jennifer underwent her first interview with the police, and she was arrested during her third interview. During that interview, she admitted she had hired killers, but stated that she hired them to kill her.
Oh, wow.
The police didn't.
Yeah.
Didn't really buy it, but they told her that they had computer software that could analyze untruths in statements.
Yeah.
So they're all doing some lying too.
Yeah, right.
And getting her.
Yeah, they're better liars than she is.
They're better liars. I mean, you got to be a pretty bad liar.
Yeah.
But, you know, so she's arrested. The guy that, I guess, did the shooting was arrested. Malva Ginam was arrested. So they all went to trial. They all pleaded not guilty to the charges of first-degree murder, attempted murder, and conspiracy to commit murder. But, you know, they looked at all of the, I think it's like text messages and all of them, you know, including 100 messages sent between Pan and Wong and Jennifer and Daniel in the 6 hours prior to the killing. You know, I think that the major problem with it was that, you know, is that Jennifer was not assaulted, not blindfolded, not taken to the basement, not shot.
Yeah.
And the dad was alive.
Right.
So he was there to, you know, give witness to it.
Yeah.
So they, you know, they were guilty.
Yeah.
Pan is, as of 2016, Pan is serving her sentence at the Grand Valley Institution for Women in Kitchener, Ontario. Wong, the boyfriend, Daniel, is also in prison at Collins Bay Institution in Kingston. The other shooter, one of the shooters, Malva Ginam, is in Atlantic Institution in New Brunswick, all these British Columbia places. The media reaction is that it sent shockwaves across Canada and the Asian diaspora. It's sort of like Asians all over.
Oh, yeah.
Be freaking out.
Right.
Because it's like, you know, I could see that you could almost justify it as like, is she kind of folk hero to stand up to the tyranny of that kind of an upbringing?
I mean, it's like she's kind of like a brilliant sociopath, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's nasty, too. It's like because you see like part of her journey is like I really recognize those feelings of hopelessness and helplessness growing up in a fiercely driven Asian family.
Right.
You know,
I think there's other ways to get out of it, though.
There's other ways. I mean, just like I'm not going to school.
Yeah.
Like I'm going to get a job.
Exactly.
It's like, bye.
Let me live with uncle and auntie or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
I think that the moment she lied about getting gang raped is like when it's like, you can't really justify this anymore.
No.
You know, I have a thing where I have a real hatred of anti-heroes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're portrayed a lot on television nowadays where it's like, this person's justified in their evil, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, yeah, you can say that there's a lot of oppression and there's, like, even systemic oppression, but it doesn't warrant, like, a death sentence.
Right.
And, like, the parents didn't deserve that, you
No.
know? Like, and I'm saying, like, is it admirable or whatever? You know, I can see some people, like, really looking up to her.
Mm-hmm.
Because what she did was she shattered some expectations of what Asian people are capable of.
Right.
Right. Like, she might be, like, the first Asian sociopath,
mm-hmm.
and people might look up to that.
Yeah.
You know, like people like write letters to people in jail and fall in love with them and stuff.
Right.
I bet you she has a lot of that.
Yeah. I recognize a lot of myself in her.
Yeah.
Like I recognize those feelings of complete like rage at the way that I was raised and anger at the parents. And like I see now as an adult looking back, it was all in my best interest.
Yeah.
They just wanted me to have a chance in life.
Yeah. Well, I think you can look at it both ways. I think you can look at it like they were horrible and she was also really bad,
mm-hmm.
but she was worse than they were.
Yeah.
Yeah. As like, you know, at least their intentions were good.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think a lot of Asian parents like should really chill out a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, let your kid have a little fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, it's a pretty horrible story.
It's a horrible story, but it's like such a, to me, I find it really compelling because it's like,
oh, it's very compelling, yeah.
You know, like, oh, here's somebody who just stood up against it. And of course she's a sociopath, and of course there is something definitely wrong mentally happening.
Yeah.
But how much is that, like, created by her parents, like, the strictness, the oppressive nature of growing up in a household like that?
Yeah, you know what's really, like, what sounds really kind of ironically sad about the whole thing is that she seems brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Like the amount of lying that that takes and everything, and like having to think of more lies and having to like figure out where you're going to be during those lies, mm-hmm. and everything. It takes a lot of intelligence.
Yeah.
So I think if her parents kind of chilled out a little bit and like raised her in a different way, she could have been a different person.
Yeah.
Not just maybe not getting good grades, but like being successful in something.
Yeah.
And I wish that that would have happened instead.
I know.
Yeah.
It's like the intensity of like the compartmentalization.
Yeah.
Like you can sort of do so much if you can create that many spaces in your brain.
Yeah.
And occupy that kind of like all of those personalities and what, you know, what is possible, like what's possible for her.
Yeah. I mean, like I'm a terrible liar, you mm-hmm. know, and I am. Like my lies fall apart pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I did something similar where I told my parents that I was a theater major, and they said, you got to quit being a theater major because you'll never make money.
Mm-hmm.
So they made me an English major.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, what are you going to be when you grow up? And I'm like, I'm going to be a teacher and I'm going to get my teaching credentials.
Yeah.
And I just told them that. And I never took a single class for my teaching credentials.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day they were like, what about your classes for your teaching credentials? And after like two questions, I just went, I've been lying to you for 6 years. Like, I just fell apart. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wasn't like her.
Yeah.
Where I had these like long involved like lies and everything. I don't know how people do it.
It's hard. Yeah. It's really hard. I'm like a really bad liar because everything, it sounds like I'm asking a question. I'm like, did you do this? Mm-hmm. My voice was good. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Like my voice starts to like, that's really squeaky.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure. Why not? It's like really, it's hard to lie. Also, I'm dumb. So I like really can't remember anything.
Yeah, I can't. Yeah, because you have to be smart to be a good liar.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to keep up with everything, consistent stories and everything.
Yeah. I'm like such a stoner too. Like, oh, I'm not a stoner anymore, but I was. So like my memory, its capacity is like terrible. So that combined, former stoner and menopause, I'm like a walk, like an etch a sketch. If I walk around, it just erases it.
Yeah.
Shakes it all down.
It's funny.
So dumb. Well, thank you. That was excellent. We did that for our very first Mortal Minorities. And where can people see you? So we are doing a show together. You and I are doing a show at Largo August 9th.
Yeah, that's my next big show.
Yeah.
After Clusterfest, it wasn't like I haven't really booked any big shows after that.
Yeah. Well, this is going to be another big show. And then we'll do more.
It's going to be a really big one. Yeah.
Lots and lots more.
I love Largo. It's one of my favorite places to perform.
Yeah, it's really cool.
It's really awesome.
It's going to be a good one.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Never miss an episode of The Margaret Show. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. The Margaret Show is an Erio's production with editing by Kat Hong and original music by Garrison Starr.
Powered by ACAST.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.